If the world cannot give us by itself any wisdom about work, or rather just confused messages, such as we see in the book of Ecclesiastes, then we need to be turning to what God has to say. And as usual, when you start to look at a biblical topic, you start with the topic of God, and you start with the creation story. For our meaning and our purpose is established first by God creating us for his purpose. And finally, in the judgment at the other end of the world and the other end of life, the judgment that has commenced in the death and resurrection of Jesus. But we look firstly then at work in creation and turn in our Bibles to the opening chapters of Genesis. Genesis chapter 1, and you see there in verse 1, in the beginning God created. God is not passive, God is not uninvolved, God is not inactive, God created, God made. And so go across to chapter 2, verse 2, chapter 2, verse 2, and on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. They're the first references to the actual word work in the Bible, and it's God who does the work. For we see the very strange idea, strange for many people, a strange idea that we now take for granted, a strange idea of the working God. God is introduced to us as the creator of all things, the sovereign, powerful ruler and owner of everything. But God is also introduced to us as the worker, the maker, the manufacturer, who worked and who also rested from his work. He is the one who by his words has made everything, for the whole creation is the work of his hands. Come with me to Psalm 92, page 599. Psalm 92, page 597. And we read, it is good to give thanks to the Lord, to sing praises to your name, O Most High, to declare your steadfast love in the morning and your faithfulness by night, to the music of the lute and the harp, to the melody of the lyre. For you, O Lord, have made me glad by your work. At the work of your hands I sing for joy. How great are your works, O Lord! Your thoughts are very deep. Or go across the page to Psalm 95. Psalm 95. Pick up that one from verse 3. For the Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods. In his hands are the depths of the earth, and the heights of the mountain are his also. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Now, growing up in a Christianized world, as most of us have and some of us haven't, but growing up in a Christianized world, we sometimes miss the radical and startling claims that the Bible is making. A worker God was very different from the other gods of the ancient world. And such an idea marked the Jews out as very different, not only in their attitude to God, but also in their attitude to work. The Greek, for example, saw that man, having soft hands, was a nobleman. His hands had never seen work. It was a sign of nobility and of being a gentleman, because there are no calluses on your hands, the nails are nicely cut, there's no hard work that has ever been expressed in these hands. You were one of the upper class, one of the sophisticated, one of the educated, because your hands were soft. Today, the Eastern religions still despise manual work. The Hindu sees it as the preserve of the untouchables. Manual work, work with our hands, was ugly, dirty, servile, was slavery. Only slaves do that. Those with calluses on their hands were the lowest of the low. And you can still see some aspects of that in Western civilization. Academic gowns. Ever looked at academic gowns? What stupid things they are. They're meant to be stupid. That's the very nature of them. Because they're the kinds of things you could never work in. Long, flowing sleeves, which would make it impossible for you to work. It's a statement that I am above work. Or Joseph. You remember Joseph, who was his father's favourite, and he had a coat of many colours. Actually, that's a bad Hebrew translation. It wasn't a coat of many colours. It was a coat with long sleeves. Because he, being the favourite, was not required to work out in the fields like his brothers. He stayed at home in his long-sleeved coat as his father's pet. Little wonder his brothers despised him so much and sold him off into slavery, and that's another story. I'm a happily married man. I've been married for 41 years, but I don't wear a wedding ring. Never have, never will. Partly because the wedding service of the prayer book had no place for wedding rings when I got married. But basically because my father never wore a wedding ring, nor did my uncles. I come from a working class family. My father was a printer. Printers who wear wedding rings are printers who only have 9 fingers. You don't deal with heavy machinery full of rings on your hands. The idea of wearing rings and of jewellery is part of the effete, wealthy, upper-class fashion, denying the value and status of work, of manual work, of hard physical work. And still today, the people who do the hard, dirty, manual work in Australia are the latest wave of migrants. They come to these shores to work hard so that their children do not have to face the factories, but can go on to university and become part of the professional class and wear rings and own their own business or their own farm and not have to work as hard as that first generation of migrants has always had to work hard in Australia. But within the Bible, work is done with a hand and is valuable and is worthwhile. For our God is a worker who manufactured and made things. Jesus is called a tectone, a tradesman, a carpenter, the son of a carpenter. Paul was a tent maker. Peter, James, John, Andrew, they were fishermen. The thief is told by the apostle Paul to no longer steal, but to do honest work with your hands, that you may give to those in need. Now, presumably there's something of a contrast in his work. He's been using his hands to take. Now he's got to use his hands to give. But nonetheless, there is still the nobility, the rightness of doing manual labour. Because we don't want to do manual labour, or most of us don't anyway, the dirty hard labour, we underestimate the importance of God as a worker and of work itself being honourable. The nobility of work is seen in both Old and New Testament, but it's lost in our affluence. And so we talk about work a lot, but we rarely mean manual physical work, cleaning, washing up, garbage removal. Rarely do I have ever had Christians telling me that the Holy Spirit has led them to be street sweepers. The Holy Spirit's a very middle-class Holy Spirit. He always leads people to be doctors, dentists, lawyers. He's always on the upwards aspirational track for you. Our discussions of work, the discussions of the chattering classes, are often laced with those middle-class aspirations. I like the feminist rhetoric about the glass ceilings, as if rising to the top is necessary for you to be genuinely working and fulfilled and satisfied. There's no way in which you can stay down at the basement and have a fulfilling work job. Back to our friend Mr. Gittins. He's written on another article in which there are 3 kinds of works, he says. Jobs, that's where you work for your living. The only reason you're doing it is because the paycheck. Careers, where you work for your advancement. The money you're being paid, well, it's sufficient that it doesn't worry you particularly. What you want is the partner coming and putting his hand on your shoulder and saying, that was a really good job you did there. That was a fine case. You'll be an associate soon. You'll be a partner one day. You'll move on from here to being a company director. You'll move on from here to... And then there's a third kind of work, hobbies. Mr. Gittins, you see, Salvation Army, can't help himself. He calls it vocations. He goes religious on us again. But hobbies, that is, where we work, where we get paid for our pleasure. The footballer, the cricketer, the musician, the drummer, which is slightly different to the musician, I understand. There are all kinds of people who will do what they would do anyway, but they're being paid to do it. Now, much of the chattering classes and the intelligentsia debate about work, but their debate is really about that second kind of work, isn't it? About careers. It's how to advance through the meaningful appointments to find ourselves more important, more influential, rewarding, powerful, interesting positions where we can find self-satisfaction and fulfillment and meaning and use my talents and my abilities to the full, where I can grow and develop as a person. But Mr. Gittins points out in the article that on average, those who do a job are happy. And those who are paid for their hobby are really happy. And those who pursue a career are discontent, dissatisfied, and miserable. The unhappiest workers in the marketplace are the careerists. They are never satisfied. As you actually reach the top and the pinnacle, there'll always be someone behind you trying to push you off it. The problem I wish to suggest to you, friends, goes back to the failure to understand the doctrine of creation. Failure to accept the doctrine of creation leads to the denigration of work, especially manual work. Knowing God is a worker removes from us any disparagement of those who work, whatever their job may be. Whatever task you may be doing, if you're doing that task, you are like God. And it is a good thing, and a right thing, and a proper thing. And you should be rewarded and respected for doing that which God does, work. But there's a similar and symmetrical problem with rest. For failure to accept the doctrine of Sabbath leads to the glorification of work, especially professional work. That's because not only is God the working God, but he is also the resting God. The passage that describes God's creation as his work does so to introduce the idea of his rest. Come back to that Genesis 2 passage and verse 2. I know it's words that you know well, but look again at what it is saying to us. Genesis 2, verse 2. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, separate, different to all the others. Made it holy because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. The meaning of the word Sabbath is critical here. For the Hebrew verb to rest is Shabbat, is Sabbath. It's where the word comes from. You could translate it that on the seventh day God finished his work that he had done, and he Sabbathed on the seventh day from all his work he had done. So he blessed the seventh day and made it holy because on it God Sabbathed from all his work that he had done. And this introduces, therefore, this very important word and concept of rest, of Sabbath, which is over against and opposite work. But Sabbath is not just a negative term, as rest is, a kind of nothingness. I work hard and then I rest. I don't do anything, I just rest. No, Sabbath is to enjoy the fruit of your labour, is to be refreshed in the purpose of your endeavours. It's like the other Hebrew word, shalom, which we know as peace. See, in our modern English language, peace generally means just the cessation of war. And so it's a kind of negative word. It's an empty word. You either are at war or you don't have war. If you don't have war, that's called peace. But shalom is not like that. There's no peace when you lose a war. There is for us. We're at peace now. We've just lost the war, but we're at peace. No Jew thought that. That's daft. You're only at peace when you win. Then you're at peace. And so peace has got to do with being healthy, well-being, in prosperity. It's not living away from your neighbour at peace, it's living with your neighbour in harmony. It's a positive concept. Well, so likewise, Sabbath is not just the absence of work, it's the enjoyment of the fruit of your labours. It's the pleasure of living at peace in shalom. You see it in Exodus, where the people of Israel were to enter the promised land, the land of Sabbath, the land of rest. For they would rest from their labours in the difficult march across the wilderness by living in a land, but notice the land that they were going to live in was flowing with milk and honey. Each man under his own house, under his own fig tree, under his own grapevine, eating of the vines that somebody else had planted and worked, living off the crops that somebody else had planted, living in a house that somebody else had built. Now that is peace. That is rest. That is Sabbath. That is terrific. Here I am living in all the pleasures of the promised land. But even when we grasp this positive understanding of the Sabbath, we still haven't noticed the wonderful thing that is being said here in Genesis 2, verse 2. That is the implications of the Sabbath. It is God who rests from his labours. That is, work is not the sum total of God's concerns. There's more to God than work or than creation. For God enters into the enjoyment of his work. And there's more to creation than work. There's more to God than work, and there's more to creation than work. There is also the restful enjoyment of the creation on the seventh day. This seventh Sabbath day then becomes like the promised land, a picture, a way of talking of heaven, of our eternal rest with God, in the harmonious relationship with God, of enjoying God's work with him forever. Interestingly, in the Bible, there's never an eighth day. We are still in the seventh day. God is in the seventh day today. I don't want to enter into long discussions with anybody today on how many days there were or weren't in creation and how long each of the days were, etc. I just want to point out to you, the Bible never has an eighth day. We are still in the seventh day. For God is still resting from his labour. He's not creating new worlds. He's not creating new universes. He's enjoying the creation that he has made. And we are invited into that rest in Psalm 95. For it talks not only of the God, the Creator, that Israel must bow down and worship, but also of the God who kept the whole generation out of the promised land, out of the land of rest. Let's look quickly at that Psalm 95. Psalm 95. Psalm 95, page 599. Pick it up from verse 6. O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker. For he is our God and we are his people. We are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. Today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah and as on the day of Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who go astray in their heart and have not known my ways, and therefore I swore in my wrath, they shall never enter my rest. Now this psalm is taken up in Hebrews chapters 3 and 4 to hold a parallel warning to Christians about entering into the remaining Sabbath rest of God through our relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ. For just as they escaped out of slavery and were heading for the land of rest and yet all perished in the wilderness, so we have been rescued out of the slavery of sin and are heading towards the promised land of rest with God for eternity. They fell in the wilderness. Make sure you do not fall in the wilderness. Make sure you enter into the rest of God. And that is why the commandment was given to his people that they must keep holy, keep separate this seventh day. We live for the seventh day. And so every seventh day, take it off to remind yourself that we live for the seventh day. But the reasons for keeping the Sabbath day are different in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. You remember the Ten Commandments are given in two forms in the Old Testament, Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5. They are identical Ten Commandments except on the Sabbath. For in Exodus 20, you're to keep the Sabbath because God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. In Deuteronomy 5, you're to keep the Sabbath day because God has rescued you out of slavery. They are both the same, really. God has created the world that we may enjoy it with him and the Sabbath rest. God has rescued us so that we may enjoy his world in the Sabbath rest. God did not only create us to work, he did not only redeem us to work, he created us and redeemed us that we may enjoy his Sabbath with him forever. So as Israel would rest on the Sabbath day, they were participating in the very reason for their creation as a nation. They were participating in their very redemption out of slavery. They were reflecting the character and the nature of God, both who both works and rests. And they were trusting him to look after the world for 24 hours without them. Come back to that Psalm 92. Should be just back a page from where we were in Psalm 95, Psalm 92. Look at the heading of this psalm. Not the one in black that the publishers have given to us, which is nowhere in the Bible, but the one that's actually at the top of it, a psalm, a song for the Sabbath. Here's a psalm of the Sabbath. What a wonderful psalm. So what's it say? It's good to give thanks to the Lord, to sing praise to your name, O Most High, to declare your steadfast love in the morning and your faithfulness by night, to the music of the lute and the harp, for the melody of the lyre. For you, O Lord, have made me glad by your work. At the works of your hands I sing for joy. How great are your works, O Lord! Your thoughts are very deep. The stupid man cannot know, the fool cannot understand this. That though the wicked sprout like grass and all evildoers flourish, they are doomed to destruction forever. But you, O Lord, are on high forever. Behold your enemies, O Lord, for behold your enemies shall perish, all the evildoers shall be scattered. But you have exalted my horn like that of the wild ox. You have poured over me fresh oil. My eyes have seen the downfall of my enemies, and my ears have heard the doom of my evil assailants. The righteous flourish like a palm tree, and grow like a cedar in Lebanon. They are planted in the house of the Lord, and flourish in the courts of our God, and they still bear fruit in old age, and they are ever full of sap and green, to declare that the Lord is upright. He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. So there's the psalm of the Sabbath. My enemies will be destroyed. They'll be defeated. Your enemies, God, they're destroyed. They're defeated. And you and I are going to live together with trees and abundance. We're going to flourish. We're going to enjoy life. Even into our old age, there will be still sap coursing through our... I'm never quite sure that I want to be the sap in the family tree. But there'll still be sap that is there giving forth so that we will be fruitful right to the very end of time. That's the Sabbath. The Sabbath is the good life. Here is what the godly do on the Sabbath. What do? We take a day off to remember the works of God, to reflect upon the creation of God, to reflect upon the redemption of God, to reflect upon the future with God, to reflect upon how blessed we are for now and for eternity. Now, there's been a noticeable logic jump that I've been making throughout the talk so far, jumping from God to us, or even from God to Israel. You see, that God has made us does not necessarily mean that we have to be like God. I don't expect a dog to be like God. Why should I expect you to be like God? Except, of course, we have been told back in Genesis 1 that we have been made in the image of God. So come back to me to that famous passage of Genesis 1 verse 26, and there we read, "Then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." Here we see five things. One, man's purpose in creation. This is one of the pivotal passages of the biblical thinking. For there we see God's purpose for us. It's only initially set out there. We're going to see much more of the purpose of God when you meet Jesus, because he is the image of the invisible God. But God made us in his image to do two things. One, to have dominion and subdue everything in the world. And two, to multiply and fill his creation. This, notice, is all before the fall. Both work and sex happen before sin. They are part of our creation. A similar passage occurs in chapter 2 of Genesis. For there we read in verse 5, when no bush of the field was yet in the land and no small plant of the field had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not caused it to rain on the land, and there was no man to work the ground. And so you run down to verse 15, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it. See, man was created to be the gardener in God's garden, to be the working rulers of God's world. The animals don't have this responsibility or this joy. The cow munches grass. The dolphin frolics in the water. The snake lies in the sun. None of them have the responsibility to rule and care for God's creation. Their ecological concerns are zero. Their population concerns are zero. Global warming, human starvation, habitat degradation, species preservation are all irrelevant to the cow and the snake and the dolphin and the crocodile or anybody. They don't care. They just munch the grass. They just lie in the sun. It's man and man alone that God has given the responsibility of being in God's world as God, working to look after it and to care for it and to be responsible for it. As the psalmist ponders in Psalm 8, what is man that you're mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You've made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honour and given him dominion over all the works of your hands and put all things under your feet, sheep, oxen, beasts of the field. And again, it's the book of Hebrews that helps us see that humans are the ones to whom God is subjecting the world to come. Not even angels. They are made for us as well. And the way in which we see humans in control of the world is by seeing the one true human, Jesus Christ, the image of the invisible God, crowned with glory and honour because of his work on the cross. But that takes me off onto other subjects. So let's come back to secondly. You'll see God's work rest pattern is ours. As God works and rests, we humans are to work and rest. For we are created in his image, thus starting this talk on work in creation by noticing that God works and rests is the right way to do it. Indeed, this is what God commanded his people to do in the Ten Commandments. Work six, rest one. Funny business, really. Lots of people find it hard to rest one and complain about the commandment. Some other people find it hard to work the six. But here's the balance that our community has decided to ignore. Our community has now decided to invent its own pattern. And where our community is in constant tension about how much work and how much rest and how do you all fit it together. Listen again to my friend Mr. Gittins. If I were to assert, he said in 2007, a different article, that the pressure of working life, some of them heightened by the consequences of economic reform, are having a deleterious effect on family life, many harried parents would agree with me. But a lot of hard-nosed business people would be sceptical. All they know is that we're more prosperous than ever. 30 years ago, this is written in 2007, the average Australian worker spent less than 40 hours a week at work. The vast majority of them were in steady employment, working on weekdays only from 8 to 6. This pattern of working allowed most Australians to enjoy a consistent pattern of life outside of work, to spend predictable time with family and friends in community activities. How much has changed in the last 30 years, he says. We now have 22% of employees working more than 50 hours, and if you add in self-employed, it's 29%. We have 30% of the workforce working regularly at weekends, a proportion exceeded only by Italy. More than a third of employees usually work on Saturdays and almost a quarter on Sundays. Add to that the increase in weekday work at unsocial hours. Just between 1992 and 1997, people working after 6 in the evening or before 8 in the morning rose from 59% to 64%. That is, two-thirds of our workforce work outside normal work hours. And then there's the degree of job security we enjoy, and ease with which hours are required to work can be changed at short notice. We have 27% of the workforce now in casual employment, where they are at the fickle whim of the boss. That only Spain in the OECD countries has more casual employment than Australia. The other change, of course, is the increase in the number of women in paid employment. It's risen from 42% in 1981 to 60%. Now, most of our social activities are concentrated on the weekend, so it's not surprising that 3 million people who work on weekends are able to spend less time with the family, with the friends, and with the community. On average, 2 million Australians work on Sundays and do almost a full day, typically losing 6 hours of family time and social contact. Now, surveys have shown that working mothers sacrifice personal care, household and social time in order to minimise the lost time with children. Many parents in two-income households adopt a strategy of shift parenting. One minds the kids while the other goes to work. But Mr. Gittins points a Canadian study of the two-income families and found 26% increased risk of parental depression where the father worked unsocial hours. 41% increased risk of depression where the mother worked unsocial hours. 65% increased depression rates when both parents worked unsocial hours. This is a disaster. This is really a mad way of running your life. But you see, we've done away with the Sabbath. We're not a Christian country anymore. No more Sabbath. Okay? No Sunday. No penalty rates on Sunday. No public holidays. Well, you can work any day, every day, Easter Day, Christmas Day. It's all the same. And who is it that works those unsociable hours? Poor people. No worry. The rich are all enjoying themselves at Avoca or up on the Gold Coast or overseas or snowing somewhere, skiing somewhere. They're enjoying themselves on the public holidays. It's the poor who are called in at last minute notice to do work. Do you see what's happened to our society, to our nation, by departing from God's Sabbath pattern of the community working 6 and resting 1? The pattern of rising with the sun and resting in the evening. But come back to the Bible with me and notice that there's more about Genesis and work than this. There's also man as male and female. And that's going to be interesting to how I get through before morning tea here. It was humanity as a whole that was created in God's image. Man, male and female together. That was to multiply and fill the earth and have dominion and subdue it. For God saw that it was not good for man to be alone, and so created the woman to be the gardener's helper, united with him in one flesh. This in no way says that the woman is second rate or second because she's a helper. Remember, God also helps. But it does say that men and women have a different relation with each other and with work. It's a teaching that we ignore to our own hurt, and it's reflected in that kind of social research from the Canadians that Gittins refers to. One career is enough to ruin a family. Two careers, especially when they're heading in different directions, is a walking time bomb. Notice I said career, not job. That career sense, two people who are filled with finding their own self-satisfaction, their own fulfillment in their work and advancement and want to go ahead, pray that you're not their child. But there is still more to this creation of the male and female in the image of God. The creation of the helper for the gardener. For it brings into focus not only the ecological concern in work that the gardener has for the garden, but also the social concern that work has for humans. For there is a social nature to work itself. We work not for ourselves but for God, but not by ourselves, but as part and parcel of the image of God, which is male and female multiplying. Thus, we should not work out of envy and rivalry, competing with each other for scarce resources that we can utilise for my own benefit. I mean, you've seen the worst and the best of humanity in the last week or two in Queensland, haven't we? There is the community of volunteers helping clean up strangers' houses. And there are the looters stealing from the victims. And now we're seeing the profiteers raising prices and stealing from us all. Nobody, no single person has dominion over God's creation. Nobody by his or her work can subdue the world alone. The powerful and the mighty are dependent upon the rest of us, for we all live in mutual interdependence. There's no tyranny of second-class citizenship. The woman is his helper, and together they run the garden. For God didn't create a second man that would create two people in the image of God. He created out of the man a woman so that there would be one person, humanity, ruling the world. And this pattern of man and woman united as one to reproduce together and to live in the image of God is reflected upon the judgment in chapter 3. For the woman is judged in her relationship to her husband and her children, and the man is judged in relationship to his work. I leave you to read chapter 3, 16 following yourself, but take note of the difference. See, the reason you and I enjoy the wealth that we do from the labour we expend has to do with being Australians in the 21st century. We live in a well-ordered society and economy where there is a level of social and economic justice, a good education system, a political stability, a robust economy, and a well-controlled banking sector, unlike America. If we were living in another country where these conditions didn't exist, all the work you did and do would not add up to the same wealth we enjoy. The person living in Ethiopia, in Eritrea, the person living, they can work every bit as hard as you and every bit as hard as me and harder still and still have nothing to show at the end of the day. And the difference is you were born here or you migrated here. They were born there. Work then is a realm of social justice. It's a realm where social justice and equity needs to be exercised. It's not just a matter of efficiency, profit motive, growth. It's a realm where I can't ignore my neighbour. The rugged individualism of an atheist like Ayn Rand with her economic rationalism is the unthinking arrogance of the affluent. Only someone in New York would come up with that kind of philosophy, where might is right and where the death of the species is an improvement for what we got rid of the weak. Capitalism works and is based in greed and envy. Socialism is based in envy and jealousy. Neither are Christian in any shape, form or fashion. Both are overwhelmed by the amorality of materialism, both in its economic form, where all that matters is wealth and the only measure of value is money, and in its philosophical form, where there's no God, no eternity, no judgment. I can do what I like, there's only meaningless, valueless, random accidentalism. To divide our community, which has happened for the last 100 years plus, on the basis of our politics of a capitalist-socialist divide is to concede to atheistic materialism. That has been a downfall of our community. There are many other ways to operate. There are many options and alternatives that a Christian can put their mind to. I'm always struck by the story of that Victorian man, a Christian, a Methodist, a World War I veteran who has had a terrible stammer and suffered shell shock from the war where he'd been buried alive. When he came home to Victoria, he took up the most unlikely job for a stammerer. He became a travelling salesman. He turned to the clothing industry and the production of quality clothing that would give people value for money, that wouldn't just wear out all the time and would stick with the one sense of fashion over a long period of time. He'd read widely, and out of his reading became really concerned about the distribution of wealth in the society. He finally came across the writings of a fellow Christian, a Japanese Christian thinker and radical, Dr. Kagawa. I'm sorry for mispronunciations. From him he learnt of cooperatives, and he refounded his firm and established it. He established it so that all his workers would gain shares as they worked in his firm, that they would all share in the profits and the responsibilities for running the firm, that there wouldn't be an executive dining room and a workers' dining room. Everyone was down together in exactly the same dining room. The company and the man was Fletcher Jones and staff. But the name of it was Fletcher Jones and staff because the staff owned 50% of Fletcher Jones. It was their company, not just his, and every year they worked, they got more. Now, I'm not suggesting this is the Christian way of working, but I'm suggesting there is a man with a Christian mind trying to think out how to work and think differently. Today, of course, many companies give out shares to particular workers, but they do it out of a completely different motivation. They don't do it so as to treat people properly. They do it so as to manipulate them to work harder and longer for their company, because they found out that actually treating people properly, which Mr. Jones did, meant that you got better workers, fewer strikes, more production, and actually made money. It's a good idea to treat people rightly. Now, there are many other forms in which you can point to where people have, Christian people, out of motivation, have thought differently about work because they believe in God the Creator. It can be in the opposing of slavery by creating a cooperative. It can be insisting on a proper day's off and weekends. It can be providing quality for the customers. It can be by spending some of our profits into the needy third world. It will be by thinking out the social implications of work, because we are created to work together to fill the earth and to subdue it. However, our governments have failed us miserably in this, of course. Our governments have been so owned by the capitalists and the socialists that they are always beholden to one or the other, and now, of course, mainly to the gambling industry and the pornography industry, who own our governments on all sides of opinion. And that is why we cannot allow now have the government actually working on behalf of the good of the people from a Christian framework, because government's not allowed to have a Christian framework anymore. They've got no framework other than the framework of the market. But individual Christians can be involved in their work, making decisions that reflect the character of God. For in the end, the character cannot come from government fiat, it only comes from changed hearts, where people want to live for others. That's why Christians will seek to live and work in their own work situation differently from people around about them, because our God is a worker, and therefore all work is worthwhile. And our God is a rester. And so we don't work for work's sake, we work for rest. Rest with Him. And He has created us to work in relationship with each other, male and female, as a family of humanity. And I am not just concerned for the industrial relationships of Australia. What are the sweatshops of China? For we've solved the industrial problems here by sending them somewhere else, haven't we? Are we not concerned about workers and their rights everywhere? Or are we only concerned about certain kinds of rights and people? Is Australia our home, or is God's world our home? I'm a Christian who happens to live in Australia. I'm not an Australian who happens to be a Christian.